Hello, everybody. I was getting the right camera. Sorry for the delay starting. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was a Green Party and Socialist Party candidate for president in 2020. And this podcast, Green Socialist Notes, is about continuing to advocate and organize for the eco-socialist program that my running mate Angela Walker and I ran on in 2020. So just to open this up, I mean, it's the same topics I've been talking about in recent podcasts. Gaza, of course, U.S. rhetoric is criticizing Israel's conduct of the war, but it is not calling on Israel to stop the war. Israel has a right to self-defense, but it could do that by strengthening its military forces on the border with Gaza, not going in and slaughtering all the Palestinians in Gaza. And that border defense was weakened prior to October 7th, when Hamas invaded, because Israel had redeployed forces to the West Bank, where they're expanding settlements and ethnic cleansing with the backing of the Israeli military. And the Iron Dome protects Israel well from rockets that Hamas and Islamic Jihad often fire into Israel. That would be self-defense. What they're doing now is genocide. And if Israel's leaders really wanted peace and security, they would agree to an independent Palestinian state on the pre-1967 borders, which is what international law, the international community, wants based on UN resolutions, except for the United States primarily. And so the U.S. continues to supply weapons to Israel for its genocidal assault on Gaza. And it continues to deny funds to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for humanitarian aid to Palestinian refugees in Gaza, but also the West Bank, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. And that's just cruel. And, you know, we know people are hungry and starving, in fact, dying from malnutrition in Gaza. And the other refugees need support. And we are denying it. It's just mean-spirited. And Israel not only continues its military operations in Gaza, but now it seems to be trying to provoke a conflict with Iran by that attack on the diplomatic compound, the embassy of Iran in Damascus. And it seems Biden has taken the bait from Netanyahu, who wants continuous war to stay in power. And so the U.S. has promised to join Israel in striking back against any Iranian retaliation for that Damascus bombing, which, you know, U.S. intelligence is reporting could happen any moment. And Biden, you know, instead of spending his weekend in Delaware, is spending it at the White House with his national security staff. So something could break out at any point. And the U.S. has deployed more naval forces and got their jets scrambled. Israel's jets are scrambled. So we may be on the verge of an expanded war. And, you know, the bombing of the diplomatic compound in Damascus, with the U.S. not really condemning it, takes Israel and the U.S. back to the times before Genghis Khan and the Mongol Empire established the principle of diplomatic immunity. And we're going to put a book in the chat where it's by Jack Weatherford. It's called Genghis Khan and the Making of the Modern World. And part of what's in there is the origin of diplomatic immunity in the Mongol Empire 800 years ago in the 1200s. And I urge you to read that book. It's a compelling read or a listen if you want to do it by audiobook. And it would humble anyone who believes the Western arrogance that the West is the source of all modern progressive international political developments in the modern era. The Mongol Empire, and you can criticize a lot about it, but it did introduce things like religious tolerance as well as diplomatic immunity, which we could use more of today. So, you know, I think what this means for us as eco-socialists is we must be against all imperialisms, and we must be in solidarity with peoples and not states. And in the case of Israel, we got to keep demanding that the U.S. support an immediate and permanent ceasefire a huge surge of humanitarian aid into Gaza, the release of Israeli hostages and Palestinian political prisoners as part of that ceasefire. And then we need to cut off military aid to Israel and stop providing diplomatic cover for Israel at the UN and in other international forums, and become, and this is what the US should become, an honest, neutral broker in negotiations toward a political solution, despite the US's unconditional support, or at least tolerance, of Israeli occupation and apartheid for decades now. All the Palestinian factions want the international community, including the US, which has a lot of power and influence over Israel, to push Israel to the negotiating table and to accept international law regarding Palestinian rights. And whether such negotiations ultimately yield a two-state, a one-state, a hybrid two-state confederation is up to the Israelis and the Palestinians. But the U.S. role is to be an honest broker in that process, and our role is to change U.S. policy so it's constructive instead of being tied to the hip with Israel in its policies of apartheid, occupation, and now genocide in Gaza. And then the other thing we've been talking about, the other problem at the top of the agenda, is Ukraine. Ukraine is running out of air defense missiles, and Russia's now able to destroy whatever it wants. Lately, it's been Ukraine's energy infrastructure, its biggest hydropower plant at its biggest dam in Zaporizhia, and a huge thermal power plant near Kyiv have been struck down in the last couple of weeks, along with many other energy assets. And then we got problems at the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, which Russia's been using as a base to fire artillery shells at civilian residential areas in Kherson Oblast, north of the Dnipro River. And this shelling is just terrorism targeting civilians. There's no Russian attempt to militarily reoccupy that part of Kherson Oblast and the city of Kherson itself. So they're just shelling it. And then as far as the shelling coming out of the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, the International Agency for Atomic Energy has observers there. And they've reported not only the shelling, but also drone strikes this week that hit Russian military vehicles that are inside the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant grounds. And that's where Russia parks a lot of military vehicles and assets so they can't be shelled by Ukraine. Now, Russia's claiming Ukraine made those drone strikes, while Ukraine, of course, is saying they're Russian false flag provocations. The International Agency for Atomic Energy observers are restricted from what they can inspect at that Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. So they have not been able to make an independent assessment of those drone strikes. And the strikes, or the strikes of the power structure, the energy infrastructure of Ukraine, interrupted the electric power that keeps the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant nukes, there's six of them, cooled. The power was restored this week, but the dangers of catastrophic damage from the massive release of radiation remains high. And it remains low on the media and public infrastructure. And it's, you know, a serious problem. That nuke has become caught in the crossfire of a war by the Russian occupation. And then meanwhile, U.S. military aid to Ukraine remains stalled for 6 months now. And House Speaker Mike Johnson said he would introduce a standalone Ukraine military aid bill to the House after their Easter vacation, which was the beginning of this week that just passed. And he didn't do that. He said he would do it this coming week, but he was meeting with Donald Trump in Mar-a-Lago yesterday. The far-right Republicans, including Trump, don't want aid to Ukraine. And Marjorie Taylor Greene has a resolution introduced to remove Johnson as Speaker if he moves such a bill forward. So Johnson has a choice. Either he brings the bill forward and has to rely on the Democratic votes to pass the bill, also to say the speakership, which, you know, Democrats have said they would do if he brings the bill forward, and he'll have to rely on Democrats for the rest of this session of Congress. His other option is to not bring the bill forward in order to keep the far-right Republicans on his side. And I'm afraid he's going to take the path of least resistance and appease Trump and the far-right Republicans and let Russia just continue to pound Ukraine. Now, the Democrats have a discharge petition to force a vote on the Senate Biden bill, but it's falling short of the 218 signatures it needs. It's been on the table for a month. It only has 193 signatures. It did get two more this week, but at that rate, it's going to take months. And the progressive Democrats won't sign that discharge petition because the Senate Biden bill contains aid to Israel. So what's going on is Europe is stepping up its aid to Ukraine, but it can't match what the U.S. could provide. So we need to keep demanding that that the Congress provide that aid, oppose the far-right Republicans who support Putin, really. You know, they like his socially reactionary, bigoted strongman rule. And also against the vulgar anti-imperialists who claim to be on the left, who think the U.S. is the only imperialist power in the world, and they give Russia a pass. And that's not the kind of consistent anti-imperialism we need. So in the absence of, you know, military aid from the United States government, we can still support material aid campaigns organized by trade unions and socialists here and in Europe to provide humanitarian aid to Ukrainians. And we're going to talk a lot about this next week. Our guest will be Denis Pilash, who's a Ukrainian socialist who is an editor of Commons, which is the left-wing publication in Ukraine, and a member of Solidarny Ruch, or the social movement, the democratic socialist organization in Ukraine. So we'll have a lot more to say about that. So let me just wrap up by giving you a little good news, and it's about Donald Trump, the leader of the far-right movement in the U.S. He had another bad week. Probably the thing that hurt him the most was Bloomberg took him off their billionaires list, which must irritate Trump to no end. The precipitating factor was that Trump's social media company stock fell again this week. It closed at $32.41 yesterday. That's down 60% from its peak right after the initial public offering a couple weeks ago. And I was telling you that the revenues of that company and the losses it has had that were reported after the initial public offering showed that this thing was worth nowhere near what the market had valued it. And so I think the stock is going to continue to go down, and the 57% share that Trump has in it is going to go down, and he's going to be further away from being a billionaire than ever. And then the other thing happened is his bond to cover his fine pending in the bank fraud case in New York is in trouble. The New York Attorney General wants documentation that the sponsor of the bond, the Knight Specialty Insurance Company, can pay up if Trump cannot for the $175 million bond. And so the Attorney General made a court filing to require Knight to show that it has the financial resources to pay up when, you could say if, but I think when, Trump loses his appeal on the bank fraud case. And Knight has until just Monday to prove that it does have the resources. And if it doesn't, Attorney General Tisha James will start seizing Trump properties as collateral for the judgment that Trump owes on that case. So that's just a couple of days away. And from what we know, it looks like Knight does not have the resources to back up not just the $175 million that the bond is worth, but also the $464 million judgment in the case, which with interest is over half a billion now. The bond is worth 127% of Knight's reported $138 million surplus. So it can't pay the $175 million bond if Trump won't or can't, let alone the $464 million judgment. And Knight is backed, we call it reinsurance, by a firm that's based in the Cayman Islands, And that's where companies go, not just to avoid taxes, but to avoid transparency of their business practices and make it harder to collect money owed for criminal judgments or civil fraud judgments, like in this case, or just to pay this bond. So this bond looks like another case of fraud by the Trumpsters. So Trump on Monday may find that Tisha James is going after his properties. The other thing happening on Monday is Trump failed in all his appeals to delay the porn star hush money case. So jury selection begins on Monday. It's been 8 years since the deed was done, but finally a criminal case against Trump's many crimes is going forward. And that's good news. So I'll stop there and let's get to comments and questions. Amy L. Sachs, pretty funny, sad, if Trump, like Capone, is done over money instead of over the killing he's done here and elsewhere. The money in Capone's case, it was taxes. And in Trump's case, it's indirectly taxes because property taxes he owes, he underreports them, the value of his properties to the state, and overreports them when he wants to get money from banks. So, and Trump, the guy's a gangster. I mean, he's been that since he showed up in New York with his father, Fred Trump, and they got caught discriminating against African-Americans that wanted to rent from Trump properties. Scout Trooper 164. Howie, what do you think of Biden considering to end the charges on Assange? He's practically just sitting on his ass, and it's annoying how long this is going. Yeah, that was a surprise. It was kind of off the cuff, but seemed to reflect discussions going on in the administration. And it's about time. When Biden was vice president under Obama, they decided that it would be wrong to prosecute Assange on free press grounds. And it still is. And the government of Australia has put a lot of pressure on Biden. So maybe something's cooking. It's just not just annoying. It's infuriating how long this has taken to get Assange, you know, to free Assange. You know, the charges should be dropped. And hopefully Biden is about to do that. The question now is, okay, what is he waiting for? Scout Trooper 164, if Biden wins again, there could be another January 6th where instead of Congress, it's a national fight. I can't help but wonder of it just now. Yeah, I think the far right, including the armed far right, is spoiling for a fight. If Biden wins, you know, there may be violence to protest that or even disrupt the election again. And if Trump loses, there may be a fight, you know, armed resistance. You know, Trump has said things, I don't know exactly what they'll do, but Trump has said things like there'll be a bloodbath if he doesn't win. And they say that was in the context of, what was it, about auto factories, I think. But you look at the larger context and it was, you know, if he didn't win the election. He is creating a climate where, you know, the far right that is armed and spoiling for a fight is going to go look for targets. Either way, the election goes. So, you know, I think it's something to keep in mind and prepare for. Maggie Gomez, how do we get free and fair elections? Well, you know, I've said this many times. If I was running for president again, you know, I had three themes in 2020, the Green New Deal to address climate change, the Economic Bill of Rights for economic justice, and peace policies to end the, you know, militarism and imperialism that the U.S. is so central to, and also particularly to address the new nuclear arms race. But I think my leading theme this time would be, We need, in the case of the presidential race, to move to a ranked choice national popular vote. That gets rid of the spoiler problem. That's the first thing and just about the only thing the media says about Greens running, including Jill Stein this time. Second thing is we've got to push for proportional representation. And at the federal level, there's a bill called the Fair Representation Act. It was finally reintroduced in this session of Congress, an improved version. And you can Google that, Free Representation Act, 118th Congress. And it's improved because instead of requiring five House seats to go to at-large proportional representation, it's seven, which gives, you know, political minorities a better shot. So you can, you know, look at that bill. There's been some commentary on it. So ranked choice voting for executive offices, proportional representation for legislative bodies. And we can push that at the local and the state level. In fact, we are. We started in 2000 with just two legacy proportional ranked choice voting municipalities in the country. And by 2020, we had about 20 municipalities using either single district ranked choice voting or proportional multi-district ranked choice voting. By today, it's over 50 jurisdictions. And in the election coming up next November, there are at least four and maybe as many as six states where ranked choice voting will be on the ballot for the state, for state elections. And I don't have a count, but there are many, many municipalities moving that way. From Washington, D.C., I just read there was another, Jersey City, New Jersey, just decided to go ahead with ranked choice voting. So that's a reform we're winning. And I think that should be a high priority for us because we get ranked choice voting, we get rid of the spoiler problem, we get proportional representation, which is best implemented, I think, in our political tradition by proportional ranked choice voting. That is ranked choice voting in multi-member districts, which gives you proportional representation of all the political viewpoints or parties in an election. And that creates a multi-party democracy. And oh, by the way, it renders gerrymandering, which is a huge problem, basically gets rid of it. It's not possible without, you know, extraordinary measures to gerrymander multi-member districts with ranked choice voting, because every party gets its proportional share. That is, you know, the second reform. And of course, there are more things we need to do. We need to get the Voting Rights Act restored to protect the voting rights of African Americans and other ethnic minorities that are discriminated against by the powers that be in many states. And here the Democrats, you know, have to be called out because they had majority in both houses of Congress in the first 2 years of the Biden administration, but because they wouldn't take on the filibuster in the Senate, they couldn't get restoration of the Voting Rights Act and a whole lot of other electoral reforms that were good, including election protection from the kind of laws and intimidation that's going on. You know, the right-wing intimidation of election workers has created a shortage of people that just don't want to risk the harassment and even violence that they face. And that electoral reform package could have passed if they'd taken on the filibuster, the Democrats, and they didn't do that. So we need the Voting Rights Act restored. We should go for public financing of public elections and not just the matching funds thing, which actually increases the disparity between lower funded and higher funded candidates. It should be full public campaign financing. You qualify for the ballot, you get an election grant, everybody gets the same grant to run their election, and that levels the playing field. Actually, Joe Biden had that in his platform running for president. I think it was kind of a legacy of what was a much more broadly supported and popular demand in the 1990s. It was called clean money, clean elections. And that was a system where, like I just described, full public financing, you qualify, you get an equal grant with everybody else. And Biden actually said in his platform that he wanted a constitutional amendment to take all private money out of federal elections. And then he added a line saying, if that's not possible, we'll go with what that Democratic bill was, which had matching funds provisions for the House of Representatives and made it harder for the matching funds in the presidential race. And I've talked about that a lot here. I wrote several articles in 2021 about that. But what else? The main thing, I think, is ranked choice voting and proportional representation. That will create a multi-party system and the spoiler problem and create the political space for the Greens to get their fair and proportional share of representation and power in government. And the same for, you know, all the political tendencies. We might have a 4, 5, or 6 party system like most countries with proportional representation have. That to me is the most important demand that's game changing. And it's something that should be a high priority for Greens. And if you're in one of those states that's introducing ranked choice voting, vote for it. And, you know, if your municipality is not moving toward it, organize a movement to get it in your city or town. Now, one problem with some of these state ranked choice voting measures is they also call for what they call open primaries, which is misleading. We already have open primaries in most states where when you go to the primary, you can decide which party you want to vote in. In some states, it's semi-open so that voters who are independent, not enrolled in a party, can vote in a major party primary. In New York, it's optional. Most states don't use it, but the Reform Party and the New York mayor's race several years ago allowed independents to vote in their primary. Those are open primaries. What they're talking about is you could either call them multi-partisan or nonpartisan primaries where all the parties compete in a first past the post primary. First 2, 4, or 5 past the post get to the general election. And in California, where it's first two, if you're in a Republican district, you get 2 Republicans in the general election and nobody else. You're in a Democratic district, it's usually 2 Democrats and nobody else. And so it's not proportional at all. It's winner take all. And the same thing happens in top 4, top 5. And what it does is takes away from parties the right to nominate their own candidates. So take California again. The Greens will endorse a candidate in a race, but other people can say they're a Green and pay the filing fee and get in the primary. And then the rank and file Greens, who are not as well informed on who the candidates are, but they vote the Greens because that's where their political values and policies are. They looked and they see more than one Green running in the primary. They don't know which one to vote for. So the party loses control over its nominees. And then in California, where it's only top 2, they don't get one to the general election. Where it's top 4 or top 5, you've got somewhat better chance, but still, if there's a dynamic where you're thinking, well, if I don't vote, say I'm a progressive, if I don't vote for the Democrat and vote for the Green instead, the Democrat might not make it to the general election. So you still got that spoiler problem even there. So then you got to face, well, we get ranked choice voting, but we have these stupid multi-partisan primaries where the Greens can't control our own nominees. And in that case, I think what I would do is vote to get ranked choice voting in and then fight to get back to party primaries instead of these multi-partisan primaries. But, you know, you might make the opposite calculation that let's defeat it this time and come back with something just for ranked choice voting. So there's a lot of complications there. I said a lot, but the bottom line, to get the free and fair elections, the top 2 priorities are ranked choice voting for executive offices and proportional representation for legislative bodies. That will open up the political system, particularly for the Green Party. Maggie Gomez, free on the airways too? PACs? Okay. One of the things that Clean Money, Clean Elections bill did at the federal level was require anybody who accepts public campaign financing to have to go on a publicly sponsored debate or more than one debate. Arizona has this kind of election system and it requires everybody takes the money to be in a debate. So our Green candidate for governor several years ago, Angel Torres, was on a debate with the major party candidates that was on TV. And PACs, political action committees, that's private money. So what happens in these public financing things is if it's full public financing, clean money, you can't take private money if you accept public money. In the matching funds thing that the Democrats are pushing at the federal level and in some states like New York, we've got it. The public money is on top of the private money. So it's subsidizing the major party candidates more than it's helping minor party candidates. PACs are private money. And it's, you know, they're PACs and they're PACs. They're PACs that are the political action committees of Democratic or semi-democratic organizations like trade unions or the Sierra Club, which is a membership organization. And others are just top down run by the rich, particularly the super PACs, which are not transparent. They're reporting. they don't have to report who their donors are if they're 501c4s. So, we should have equal access to the public airways in elections. And, you know, get the private money out of elections. It's a public function. It should be publicly funded. Vicki Corden, I think about vigilantes at voting polls and around drop-off boxes for absentee ballots. How do we deal with vigilantes and voter intimidation? Were there laws against that kind of practice? And we saw it in 2022, you know, armed people around drop-off points, people bringing arms to polling places, and the laws against that need to be enforced. Now, there was a legislation that passed at the federal government, which provided more money for that just recently. And damn, I'm trying to remember what bill it was in. That was the bill that took money from the public, the presidential campaign fund for public funding of presidential elections. And there are two programs there, matching funds, which Greens have taken advantage of. And then there's a general election grant, which the Greens would like to take advantage of. You have to get at least 5% of the vote to get a share of that 4 years later. And we want to keep that. And the bill raided that fund. It had $404 million in it. They took $375 million. Some of it went to the Secret Service. I think that was $55 million. And then the other $320 million went to a federal agency that is about election administration, including security. So that got beefed up some. The Republicans have been cutting the funds on that, leading the way in cutting the funds on that. So there is more money for that enforcement. But then you've got to have local jurisdictions actually enforce it. And in some cases, in some of these right-wing states, they won't enforce it. So that's a struggle, you know, depending on your state. But there are laws against it, and we just need to insist that they be enforced. Violated Content Boutique. Howie, do you think we'll finally be done with those surveillance laws that were passed after 9/11? I'm afraid not. The Patriot Act is still there. Just yesterday, they reinforced Section 702, which allows the FBI and other surveillance agencies to surveil without a warrant the correspondence of Americans who may be in communication with foreigners who are suspected of being tied to terrorists. But that gets abused. We know it was revealed that the FBI was spying on activists in the post-George Floyd murder protests, sometimes called the Black Lives Matter protests. And they were, you know, surveilling Americans, their, you know, email and so forth, without warrants. And, you know, the obvious intent was to suppress those protests, which Trump certainly wanted. And he did other things, you know, to try to repress them using paramilitary forces with the Border Patrol and so forth. I think he sent them up to Portland, Oregon. So it's been abused, and it was a very close vote, and it was one of those cases where the progressives in the Democratic Party and the far right kind of libertarian types in the Republican Party voted against it. But it passed, and I believe Speaker Mike Johnson cast the vote that broke a tie. No, we're not. The surveillance state is going strong, unfortunately. And it's an issue that ought to be part of the presidential debate. It's probably not going to be. There are other matters that will be, but it's something that civil libertarians have been pushing, and that's why this vote on Section 702 was close. And we came close to winning, but we didn't. So the struggle continues. Scout Trooper 164, shouldn't we have warrantless surveillance? This is the shit Snowden exposed. And to want to continue this crap as if the Cold War still exists is awful. Yeah, I don't think it adds to our security. What it does is add to the ability of the federal government to repress legitimate social movements and dissent from what the government is doing. The warrantless surveillance that was done by the NSA is what Snowden exposed. And, you know, Section 702 provides a legal cover for some of that. So, yeah, it's awful. And, you know, it wasn't good during the Cold War. It's not good now, even if we're beginning to get into a similar kind of Cold War situation between now various capitalist powers. Instead of the bureaucratic states of the Soviet bloc, it's capitalist Russia, capitalist China, capitalist Iran, and capitalist U.S. and West. And they're in a Cold War. And it's heating up, like it might heat up any moment in between Iran and Israel. Vicky Corden. Also, the FBI wanted a list of people watching certain videos on YouTube sometime in January 2023. I guess you're saying they went to YouTube to see who was watching these videos, which, you know, might be Al-Qaeda videos and that kind of thing. You got to decide whether you're stronger for freedom or security. And I think we should be for freedom. And, security will come if we're more free. If we're not free, then the state can repress us and undermine our security to, you know, exercise our political and democratic rights. Vicky Corden, the Arizona ruling in the 1864 law and also the Comstock Act. Any thoughts? Yeah, it's amazing. As someone who came up, you know, when Roe versus Wade was approved or was ruled by the Supreme Court, and, you know, progressive-minded people thought, you know, the right may try to mobilize around the abortion issue, but they're never going to get as far as they now have gotten. And now it's gotten absurd. I mean, it's gotten so bad in Arizona that even the, you know, really right-wing Republicans are running away from that Arizona ruling. And it's an issue that Biden is going to, drive home against Trump, who boasts that he got the justices on the Supreme Court that overthrew Roe versus Wade. And it's so bad, this Arizona law, that even Trump is saying, whoa, I want it to be a states' rights issue, not a national abortion ban, although he had previously said he would sign a national abortion ban. So the abortion issue, the people want abortion rights, to various degrees. I mean, some want some restrictions, but most people understand that, you know, that it's a healthcare issue, it's a freedom issue, and the Republicans are on the wrong side of that issue. So I think it's going to help the Democrats do a lot better than many people are worried they will do at this point with the polling this early in the election period. So I think we need to be out there, you know, supporting abortion rights. And really, the issue for the Greens is we want to codify Roe versus Wade in federal legislation so the Supreme Court, you know, can't touch it. And that's another thing that the Democrats could have done in the first 2 years when Obama was in office. There was a bill to do that. They had majorities in both houses, and Obama didn't lift a finger for it. And same thing, first 2 years of Biden. Majorities in both houses, and, you know, Biden wouldn't go after the filibuster, which the bill passed the House, but wouldn't pass the Senate, wouldn't pass the filibuster to even get it debated on the Senate floor. So we need to keep pushing that law. I can't remember the formal name of it, but, you know, it had a different name under Obama. They changed the name under Biden, but it's, you know, if you just Google bill to codify Roe versus Wade or House bill or to codify Roe versus Wade, you'll find it. Frankie Lee, do you think we can avoid war with Iran considering our inept leadership, Howie? No, I mean, Biden has said if Iran responds to the Israeli attack on the Iranian diplomatic compound and embassy in Damascus, we're going to respond against Iran in coordination with Israel. So, you know, we need to protest that, but I don't think we have the power now to stop Biden. And Biden, the right-wing Republicans will back Biden on this one. So it really depends on how big the Iranian response is and how big the U.S.-Israeli response is to Iran. But, you know, this tit-for-tat is going to keep going. I mean, the U.S., I heard Biden earlier today, a clip, you know, where he was at a news conference where he said, well, he said to Iran, don't do it. But I guess it was another spokesperson for the administration said, you know, basically the tit for tat's got to stop with Israelis' strike on Damascus. And of course, Iran's going to say, well, we get one strike back to equal the field, then we'll stop. And they won't stop either side. It's a bad situation. And all we can do is speak out against it and encourage restraint by the U.S. and also stop tying itself at the hip with Israel. I mean, like I said earlier, I think Netanyahu's trying to widen the war, make it endless, draw the U.S. in on Israel's side, and that's how Netanyahu stays in power. I mean, his polling in Israel now is 15%. It makes Biden and Trump look popular. And the only thing keeping him in power is the war. If the war is ended, they're going to go to new elections and Netanyahu's out. And he got three trials to face, not as many as Trump, but you know, they're good, strong cases of bribery and other corruption on the part of Netanyahu. What we got to do is just speak out and protest and, you know, say that, you know, the problem here is we need a new policy regarding Israel and Palestine, like I outlined before. You know, cut the military aid and the diplomatic cover for Israel until it ends its policies of apartheid occupation and particularly immediately its genocidal war in Gaza. Amy L. Sachs, do the clowns advising Biden think that voters will choose him because he'll do war better than Trump? Whatever that means, have they even thought that far ahead? Do they just not care if they win? I think most voters aren't thinking about even Israel and Gaza. The top issues are the status of the economy and can people afford, you know, food prices, gas prices, even though by, you know, standard measures of inflation is down, unemployment is down, but are people feeling it? And, you know, what they're feeling is high prices in certain areas, particularly, you know, with high interest rates, getting that car or that house. And it just feels to a lot of people that it's beyond reach. And they don't see what Biden is doing about that. Trump talks big stuff, but doesn't deliver. But, you know, some people are suckered by that. So I don't think the Biden strategy is we're doing war better. I think their strategy is abortion, student debt relief. The economy is good and getting better. Infrastructure, including climate action, as pathetic as it's been from Biden. I think he'll be hammering away on the domestic issues. And then, of course, the basic question of, are we going to remain a democracy? And he's going to say Trump is a threat to that. The foreign policy issues, they get the headlines now and again, but that's for the people that read, you know, the Washington Post or the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, or follow, you know, the cable news. And even there, they don't, you know, cable news doesn't cover these foreign policy issues that much. So I don't think, you know, Biden's advisors are worried about foreign policy. They're a little bit worried about Israel because young people, and particularly Arab and Muslim Americans, are really angry at Biden over what's going on in Gaza. But I think most of them are going to come back to Biden because Trump is obviously worse. He hates the Palestinians. He'll let the Israelis do whatever they want. Even the organizer of the vote for non-committed or uncommitted in Michigan, who is Rashida Tlaib, the congresswoman's sister, I saw a quote from her saying that, you know, in the end, you know, we're going to have to vote for Biden because Trump is worse. So I think that's where they'll end up. So I think Biden advisors are, you know, worried about that, but they're hoping, you know, the rhetorical things he's doing that I talked about at the top will be enough to bring those voters back. Most of them, very few of them, are going to vote for Trump. Some may vote for Jill Stein. But again, you know, the fear of Trump on a lot of these people is just going to drive them to Biden. I think that's the larger dynamic. Until we get ranked choice voting for president, I think that's where the dynamic is going to be in presidential elections. Scout Trooper 164, millennials and Gen Z are living paycheck to paycheck thanks to inflation and corporate greed. Got any thoughts, Howie? This is bullshit with a cherry on top. Yeah, well, you just heard some of my thoughts. I think, you know, the Biden people are going to push the economic questions, and so is Trump. That's going to be the center of debate. Now, you know, what the Democrats are offering is pretty thin gruel. And, you know, all Trump is offering is continuing the Trump tax cuts for the very rich. And he's hoping that they'll fund his campaign because he's having trouble raising money compared to what the Democrats are doing. But, you know, look at the Democrats' policies. It's, you know, to shore up with more subsidies, Obamacare, which is public subsidies for private insurance that then resists actually paying for the services you thought your insurance was supposed to cover. And, you know, what we want is a, you know, public health insurance system, sometimes called Medicare for All, although I've argued more and more the advocates, like in the Physicians for a National Health Program, are saying socialized health insurance is not enough. We've got to have a socialized medical system so that the hospitals and all the ancillary services involved in healthcare, from ambulances to funerals and funeral homes, are part of a public system where things operate at cost, not at cost plus profit, and are accountable to the people. The bill that Ron Dellums put in for about 20 years, from 1977 to 1997, for a U.S. National Health Service, provided for a democratic system where every community of 25 to 50,000 would have a community health clinic and a community health board elected 2/3 by the public, 1/3 by the healthcare workers. And then those community boards would elect district boards to cover areas of, I think it was 1 to 5 million. What you need for a general hospital. And then the next level was regional, where you have a medical center. I guess it was 500,000 to a million for the district, and then 1 million to 5 million for the regional, and then there'd be a national level. And each board would be elected by the boards under it. So you'd have accountability to the base and responsiveness by the system. And that's what we don't have even with, you know, Medicare. I'm in Medicare. You you want to get, you got a problem with Medicare, like they didn't pay for a service or they didn't acknowledge a payment you made for Part B, you know, try getting on the phone with them. You get a robot and you don't get all the options from that robot that you need. And you got to shout agent, agent, agent. And sometimes you don't even get a live person. That's not responsive. We need a democratic public service for healthcare. That's just one thing. You know, the Economic Bill of Rights, a job guarantee, a guaranteed income above poverty, universal public health care, lifelong public education, a secure retirement by increasing Social Security benefits. I think I'm leaving out one of the rights that we put in that Economic Bill of Rights. But those are the kind of programs that ought to be put forward instead of this marginal stuff that the Democrats are putting forward. And of course, the Republicans got nothing. They just got lies, like the, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene was saying, we can't give money to Ukraine because we got problems at home. But of course, the Republicans don't want to spend a penny on those problems at home. They just want to give tax cuts to the rich. So that's why we need the Green Party to put forward an alternative program that will recognize basic needs as human rights. And so people aren't living paycheck to paycheck, that they're, you know, able to pay their bills and, you know, get advance when they go to work, you know, and they're carrying their weight in society when they work. They should be able to pay for what they need in society because they work. Or if they can't work, they should be taken care of. And that's, you know, that's a lot of people. It's young people, it's old people, it's people with debilitating disabilities. It's caregivers who are not being paid, but providing, you know, essential needs. So that's why we need a guaranteed minimum income above poverty and these public services, you know, from healthcare to education to much better public transit, free public transit in metropolitan areas. There's a lot of things that we could be doing and aren't even on the table of the Congress we've got. That's why we need the Green Party. Frankie Lee, most people aren't in the stock market. If they want to win, they should talk about major changes for the working class and poor. Funny how they're not doing that, isn't it? Yeah, you know, both Trump and Biden kind of rhetorically gestured toward at least the working class. They don't really want to talk about poor people, but they don't have policies that address, you know, working people and the poor. And a stock market, you know, that's something Trump bragged about until it collapsed in the, you know, COVID pandemic. And I haven't heard Biden brag about it a lot, but it's come back up. But you're right. Most people aren't in the stock market, certainly directly. Those that have retirement plans to their employer, preferably a defined benefit pension, but that's becoming pretty rare, or a defined contribution plan like a 401k, they're in the stock market. And it does affect a lot of people, but it's not what people are thinking about. They're not checking the stock market or their, you know, retirement plan. They're checking the price of milk or gas or whether they can afford a new car or a house or even the damn rent. via email, response to Biden canceling $7.4 billion in student debt. It's a drop in the bucket. You know, what is the total now? It's in the trillions. I can't keep track. I mean, I remember when it got to $1 trillion, then $2 trillion. I think it's at $3 trillion now. So, you know, Biden is making a gesture to act like he's concerned about it, but he's not doing what needs to be done. And he's had trouble with the courts, no doubt. But, you know, $7.4 billion compared to trillions, you know, trillion is 1,000 billion. So there's a lot of student debt out there that's not being addressed with that measure. Okay, the hour went fast for me. I hope it was useful and informative for you. As I said earlier, next week we're going to have Denis Pilash, a Ukrainian socialist with Solidarny Ruk, or the Social Movement, Democratic Socialist Organization in Ukraine. He's also an editor at Commons, which is the left-wing journal in Ukraine. And we'll talk about Ukraine, what's going on with the politics and the military situation in Ukraine. They just, the Rada, their parliament, just passed a mobilization bill expanding who's eligible for their draft because, you know, manpower shortage or people power shortage for the military is a problem. They're running out of ammunition, artillery shells, and defense missiles in particular. And Denis lives in Kyiv, and the biggest power plant in the country, about 30 kilometers or 20 miles south of Kyiv, was destroyed, totally destroyed by Russian missiles. 8 missiles hit it, and they don't have the air defense missiles to stop those incoming missiles. And the system that can do it is the U.S. Patriot missile system. But, you know, that's a case where, you know, U.S. at the beginning of the war didn't provide it, and Ukraine's been demanding it since 2014 when the Russians first invaded. And then finally, after Russia had pounded energy infrastructure all winter in 2023, they said in April, okay, we'll give it to you. They got it in the summer of 2023. And for the next 6 to 9 months, Ukraine cities were fairly safe because those Patriot missiles were knocking out the cruise missiles that Russia was targeting at Ukrainian cities and infrastructure. But now they've run out of those air defense missiles. So anyway, Denis will talk about that and his thoughts about, you know, how we should be in solidarity with Ukraine, given that Congress seems to not care. So I hope you can make it next week, same time, same place, and have a good week, everybody.